Welcome to the latest podcast from the Institute of Economic Affairs with me, Syed Kamal. I'm the Academic Research Director at the IEA, and I'm also a Professor of Politics and International Relations at St Mary's University, Twickenham. If you've heard of the long-running trade dispute between Airbus and Boeing, you might be forgiven for thinking it's only of interest to plane spotters or trade nerds. But this tussle between the world's two largest manufacturers of commercial aircraft also has an impact on the prices of other products, such as bed linen, luxury clothing, biscuits, whiskey, and other alcoholic tipples produced by British manufacturers. Well, how can this be, you ask? Well, after a recent World Trade Organization ruling against Airbus, the US government decided to levy import taxes on imports from the EU, including from the UK, given that the UK is a partner in Airbus with France, Germany, and Spain. But the UK has left the EU, so it can't really expect much help from the EU Commissioner on Trade, who's made it clear that he's no friend of the British government. And even though the UK is negotiating a new trade agreement with the US, British companies will still be hit with import tariffs due to the ruling against Airbus. Now, some Brits may say, well, this is not really cricket. Critics will say that this shows that the so-called US-UK special relationship is meaningless. Well, let's not forget that Americans prefer baseball to cricket. And besides, Trump may claim to be friends with the British Prime Minister, but he's not going to let that get in the way of hard-nosed trade negotiations. Now, to discuss this dispute and what the British government can do about it, I'm delighted to be joined by Shankar Singham, CEO of Compotair, a US and UK trade lawyer and an IEA fellow, who wrote a recent paper proposing early harvest measures to reduce the impact on British exporters, as well as Dan Eikenson, director of the Cato Institute's Herb A. Stoffel Center for Trade Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. Gentlemen, thank you very much for joining me today. Now, let's start with you, Shankar. What's going on? Can you briefly summarize the dispute? And why isn't the US showing some goodwill towards the UK, especially since we're supposed to have this so-called special relationship?
Yes. So this dispute is essentially, as you said, between the two big large-scale civil aviation, civil aircraft manufacturers, Boeing and Airbus, US and EU. It's a very long-running issue. It's been dragging on for years, closing in on a couple of decades. And the US has alleged, and Boeing has alleged, that Airbus is subsidized in violation of the agreement in the WTO on subsidies and countervailing measures and the special provisions on the aircraft sector. The aircraft sector understanding, and sued the EU in the WTO. The EU countersued for similar violations of subsidies, mostly in the case of the US at state level. In any event, there's a dispute about this, and both sides have brought sort of cases against each other. What happens in the WTO is if a panel finds, or the appellate body finds, that one side is in violation of the rules, there's no mechanism where it can order that side to comply with the rules. Instead, what it does is it says to the plaintiff, we found a violation of the rules, and you can suspend your, in trade language, you can suspend any concessions you've given to that other party in trade negotiations. Now, leaving aside the fact that we shouldn't really describe them as concessions because they are of benefit to us. When you lower your tariff, you increase competition. It's good for you. It's good for consumers. Leaving aside that point, the US got a ruling and went to the WTO again and asked for a set of concessions to be suspended, which means elevation of tariffs to either MFN levels to 100% or to higher, or to, you know, any kind of tariff level above the current agreement between the parties in the WTO. And that's what they've done with certain products. Now, when you retaliate, and this is the so-called retaliatory tariffs, when you retaliate, what you're trying to do from a tactical perspective is you're trying to get countervailing power in the defendant market from people who have political power over that, over the capital, over the government of that market, to offset the power that the defendant company that benefits from the trade violation already exerts. So essentially, you always see these retaliatory tariffs. In the case of the US retaliating against the EU, you always see the same sorts of products. You see Scotch whiskey, you see French wine, you see French champagne, you see all the products where the producers of those products are deemed to be politically powerful, because the hope is that they will go to the European Commission and will say, you've got to bring yourself into compliance because we're being hit by these retaliatory tariffs. That's the way the playbook has been played. And the EU will retaliate against iconic products in the US, like Harley-Davidson motorcycles and Levi jeans and this sort of thing. So the idea is, you know, can you offset the political power? Can you get a bit of a, you know, frankly, a bit of a media story as well to make this all happen? The problem here is that the UK has left the European Union. And as you said, the European Commission has said very clearly that they are not interested in defending the rights of UK companies in respect of these retaliatory tariffs or prioritising UK business in any way. So they will quite willingly throw Scotch whisky under the bus for French wine or whatever it happens to be. So the whole purpose, the tactical purpose of the retaliatory tariff in the case of the US is to secure European Union compliance with WTO rulings. Not only will this, the raising of the tariff on Scotch whisky, not only not achieve that goal, and there is a big decision USTR has to make on August the 12th about increasing the number of products covered by these tariffs, increasing it from single malt whiskies to including blended whiskies, which will have a very significant impact on the Scottish whisky industry. But basically, in addition to not achieving the goal of compliance with the EU, in fact, far from it, the EU will be only too delighted to see a rift between the UK and the US and erosion of support for the US Free Trade Agreement in the UK. They will be only too delighted to see tension between Scotland and the rest of the UK at a very sensitive time, because we have the internal market white paper that has just come out. We're going to have legislation on the internal market coming up, because that undermines the UK's negotiating position with the EU. So the Commission will, and of course the Commission's also happy that retaliatory tariffs are not directed to existing European member states. So it doesn't achieve anything from a US perspective, except, ironically, make compliance even less likely rather than more likely from the EU. And that's why we think that getting the UK, which has left the European Union, you know, as of January 2020, getting the UK out of the line of fire of retaliatory tariffs that the US might impose for what are primarily European violations, primarily in the case of Airbus, but we are going to have a lot more US WTO cases brought against the EU because of agricultural SPS issues, for example, and the whole direction of travel of European SPS, sanitary and phytosanitary regulation in the agricultural area, their farm to fork strategy, all of that. And we don't want, you know, the UK does not want to be caught by all of those retaliatory tariffs, because the EU is unlikely to comply with any WTO ruling in those areas. And we also think that in terms of the negotiation, that's why we've talked about early harvest measures, getting the UK out of that retaliatory tariff fire is very important. But also, you know, you can close off chapters of the agreement as was done with the USMCA, where there are non-controversial chapters. There are a whole set of things the US would like to see, and you can put those in those early harvest measures as well.
Okay, Shag, we're going to come back to the issue of early harvest measures or proposals, but I want to bring Dan in here. Dan, is that from your perspective, is that a reasonable summary of the situation, or is there anything you want to add? And how have we got to this situation? Hey, you know, the US and the UK are supposed to be great pals. You know, Trump's supposed to be pals with Boris Johnson. We're supposed to have this special relationship. How have we got to this situation?
Yeah, great, great question. I do agree with the way Shankar characterized the WTO and the dispute. It's a long-running dispute. You know, predates Trump. I do like the way Shankar described how the WTO how the appeal to withdraw concessions, how that works. And I just wanted to elaborate on that to explain why it's supposed to work. You know, there have been a lot of accusations, certainly in the United States, that the WTO usurps U.S. sovereignty and forces us to do things that we haven't agreed to want to do. But this is a perfect example. The WTO really does have no authority. It makes suggestions. And in this dispute, like in every other dispute, the appellate body or the panel at the end says, you know, we find the EU in violation of Article X of this agreement, and we recommend they bring their practices or their laws or regulations into conformity with the agreement. And if they don't, then the US can seek retaliation or to withdraw concessions, as Shanker said. And the idea is to compel other interests in the offending jurisdiction in the EU to put pressure on the government to come into compliance. So typically that works, and it's worked in the past. You know, in the early 2000s, George W. Bush imposed steel tariffs. The Europeans and the Japanese and others retaliated against the United States and announced a list of products against which tariffs would be imposed, including citrus from Florida and textiles from North Carolina and Harley Davidson's. And what that does, it lights a fire under these other interests that didn't have a dog in the fight to begin with. They didn't care about the steel tariffs. All of a sudden, they're adversely affected. They weigh in Washington to affect the polity in that manner. And that's a way to preserve sovereignty, throw it back into the domestic arena to get it resolved. And that's, to me, that's supposed to work well. And I mean, it has worked well. The problem with the Trump administration is that Trump is a tariff man, and so is Lighthizer. And these guys are a major departure from trade policy that we've seen since, you know, the early 1930s through 13 administrations. This administration does not see trade as beneficial to all parties. They see it as a zero-sum game. And Trump fancies himself a great negotiator, and he likes to have as much leverage as possible. And certainly going into the US-UK bilateral trade negotiations, I think he considers it a negotiating chip to have the authority to levy tariffs on scotch and gin and then products from the continent as well. So even though there may be a special relationship that we like to talk about, and that Trump was gung-ho about the US-UK relationship or agreement, he's not big on goodwill, and he wants to preserve as much leverage as he can get. So maybe, you know, the United States right now there's an asymmetry here, because the United States was granted the authority to withdraw concessions to the tune of about $7.5 billion of tariffs. The Europeans' countermeasure has not been approved yet. It was supposed to be, an arbitrator was supposed to decide in June. The arbitrator will decide, I think, in September now. And I think that claim may be as high as $10 billion. So once Brussels has the guns to counteract the U.S. tariffs, there may be greater scope for negotiating just an end to this whole dispute, because the U.S. and Europe both claim to have come into compliance. There are doubts coming from both sides, but there is greater scope for negotiating a settlement if both parties have access to these retaliatory tools.
So come back to you, Shanker. You, in your paper, talk about a solution or a proposal for the UK, given what both you and Dan have said about the dynamics of the situation. And you start talking about early harvest measures. Can you explain what you mean by early harvest measures? And also, what do you actually propose?
Yeah, so it's important to note, what we haven't proposed is a sort of interim agreement or a mini deal or anything like that. The US has done that with China, notably with the phase one deal with China and a sort of phase one, if you will, deal with Japan. I don't think there's much either USTR or congressional appetite for that sort of thing. But on the other hand, what early harvest measures do is it's a sort of down payment on the deal. It's it's an indication of momentum. We're coming towards the US presidential election. I think it's quite important for both the US and the UK to demonstrate significant momentum in this trade negotiation, absent you know, some key difficult issues, obviously, in agriculture and with respect to things like the digital services tax in the UK, standards and some other areas. There are some relatively non-controversial chapters that, you know, could be closed. And I go back to the USMCA renegotiation, where was done in about a year because, you know, non-controversial chapters were being closed essentially in real time. And obviously, there's no full deal until everything is decided. It's a single undertaking. But I think this would be a good manifestation of that kind of momentum. And I think it would be useful for the US to be able to do this because, you know, they might want to insert some guardrails into the negotiation as they go forward on things that are of great interest to them. So obviously they have great interest in agriculture. They have interest with respect to the digital services tax. They have interest with all these things. You can put some guardrails in that will steer the negotiation a bit more than the current US negotiating objectives might be able to do. And you can make a clear statement. If it were possible to the US to punish the Scotch whisky industry, and that would lead logically to compliance by the EU of the Airbus ruling, then, you know, that would be a logical thing to do. The problem is it's not going to have any effect on that because, as I said before, the UK has left the EU. I think what tends to happen with these retaliatory tariffs is, you know, lobbyists from industry that essentially brought the case, obviously they want to see maximum compliance and they have a playbook for doing this. The playbook consists of who are the well-known politically active interests that Dan mentioned, who can intervene with Brussels effectively. And in the past, absolutely the Scotch whisky industry, other critical UK industries would have been very powerful because the UK was a powerful member state and it would have had that influence in Brussels. The problem here for the US is that actually it's counterproductive. So while I agree with everything or many of the things that Dan said about you know, the Trump administration looking at this as a chit, it's a chit for the EU negotiation. It's not really a chit for the UK negotiation. And as a chit, it doesn't really have any effect. It doesn't really have any value. In fact, I would argue it has negative value because all that will happen is it will defray interest from the EU instead of concentrating the political pain on key sectors in the EU27. They've now brought the UK into this. The UK, by the way, is already compliant with the Airbus ruling. They have recouped all the launch aid that has been given to the UK bits of Airbus. And certainly, as part of those early harvest measures, I would say absolutely the US ought to be asking for commitments from the UK to comply with WTO agreements in the future. Commitments, for example, to comply with the WTO's SPS agreement in the future, which will be a significant difference from the European Union. So I think there's a whole range of things that it would be beneficial for the US to put in place. And let's not also forget that trade policy is not just about commercial interests. Commercial interests obviously play a very big part in trade policy, but trade policy is also part of your overall foreign policy. It's part of your geoeconomic and geopolitical agenda. And that's where I think it's important for the US. You know, this is a major event here. You've got a major G7 country that's leaving the European Union that is inserting itself into the global trade policy, you know, framework for the first time in 40 plus years. That is a major global event. Either the US is going to be able to pull the UK towards more liberalized trade, towards more competitive markets, towards less protectionism and so forth, or it's going to push the UK towards the European regulatory system with all of its protectionism and all of its WTO violative elements. And that is a choice for the US. And if they make the wrong choice, they could lose this moment. So I think it's very much in the US interest to And in fact, in President Trump's interest to do something here, to make it clear that it regards the UK differently from the EU27, and it doesn't regard the UK as a mini version of the EU27.
Okay, Dan, what's your reaction, first of all, to early harvest measures themselves, but also to Shanker's ideas for kind of de-escalating this from the UK perspective?
Yes, I think it's a very good idea. I think Liz Truss should insist that the United States exempt the United Kingdom from the 232 tariffs on steel and aluminum, and should get rid of the tariffs that are imposed on British products. We are entering we've just started a negotiation. The UK is leaving the EU. We should start on clean ground here. And, one of the reasons I think the United States is interested in an agreement with the United Kingdom, and I know this gets into to touchy areas, is to find an ally to kind of reveal, to go after the European Union's stance on GMOs, on SPS measures, on geographic indications, things like that. And I know that there's a lot of support for that still in the UK, but the Trump administration does see the peeling off of the United Kingdom as working to its advantage in advancing its trade agenda vis-a-vis the EU. So I'm a fan of early harvest. The whole concept makes a lot of sense. Let me just put that in perspective. As Shanker mentioned, most trade agreements go according to what's called a single undertaking, where nothing is agreed until everything is agreed. And I think that's what subverted the Doha round. There was plenty of scope for us to make progress in areas where things were agreed, but nobody wanted to deviate from the script and allow that to happen. So that's something theoretically we should be considering, because it does inject goodwill, which tends to produce momentum. And I do think the single undertaking process is problematic. It also adversely affected the TTIP that I think was sunk for a variety of reasons. But the inability of negotiators to break it off into parts is one of the reasons. The problem, though, is that there's a lot of institutional infrastructure in the way to having these early harvests. So with Japan, there's a preferential trade agreement, which is sanctioned under GATT Article 24. Members can engage in their own preferential agreements, provided that it addresses substantially all trade. Now, that agreement doesn't really address substantially all trade, and so it's feasible that another WTO member could challenge that FTA in the WTO. There have been a lot of preferential trade agreements negotiated by WTO members on grounds that look suspect, but nobody's really ever challenged it. So the likelihood of it being challenged is pretty slim, but it's possible, which means negotiators need to be at least mindful of that at the WTO. There's also an infrastructural a barrier within the US government. So under the US Constitution, it's the Congress that has the authority to levy taxes and to regulate foreign commerce and to enter into trade agreements. It, for many years, has granted authorization to the executive branch to do the negotiating, providing that certain benchmarks are met, and then vote yay or nay on that agreement when it's done. There's under the current Trade Promotion Authority language, there's something called Section 103A, which gives the president the authority to negotiate an agreement that deals just with tariffs. And it will require no more actions from the Congress. In other words, Congress doesn't have to vote on it. And that's how the Japan deal was put forward. For the UK, I think some of the things that the United Kingdom wants, other than getting rid of tariffs on 232 and the Boeing Airbus retaliation, which is sort of different from what we're talking about. It's not liberalization, it's just removing retaliation. Most of what is on the offensive agenda for the UK are in other areas, financial services, for example. They're in areas that will require Congress to chime in. So my point is that there isn't vast scope for early harvest measures in this agreement. There is scope for goodwill by rescinding some of the existing tariffs. But other than that, I don't see how we can make a whole lot of progress. We can close chapters, but that doesn't mean that those chapters are going to take effect until the whole agreement is completed.
Okay, Shankar, let me bring you back in. You've heard Dan react to your proposal on early harvest measures and said that's fine in theory, but he's then outlined some of the reasons in reality why that might be more difficult. How do you react to that?
Well, I mean, I would say if you look at the, and I think he's absolutely right in terms of the UK's offensive interests in financial services, in digital, in defence and so on. And that's precisely why I actually think in this particular case, it's the US that would benefit significantly from some of these early harvest measures. The UK might seek to get something in early harvest, some sort of commitment on those other areas, but it won't be worth, you know, the paper that it's written on, because ultimately it's got to pass through the TPA process and so forth in the ordinary context of an agreement. But the US, I think, can insert some guardrails and get some commitments from the UK that are perhaps more valuable. So it's not unusual in trade agreements. In fact, even in the TTIP, the original, you know, the first round of TTIP, Angela Merkel talked about lighthouse projects. You know, there would be some manifestations of that early momentum towards an agreement, which is, as Dan said, you know, the goodwill, the trust between negotiators is very, very important. And, you know, that's why I think these things could be viable, could be useful for the negotiation. And on the single undertaking point, the reason we have a single undertaking is because that you can, at the end of the day, trade off all these difficult areas against each other, and you bring it all together in a great single agreement. And we may need this, but early harvest measures don't preclude that. They don't say, well, we've agreed, you know, this element now and we're never going to go back to it. At best, even if they're not expressly conditional, any kind of agreement or early harvest or symbolic statement or whatever you want to call it, is going to be conditional on the final agreements. And frankly, if I were the US, I would also want to make this conditional on the UK actually leaving the transition period at the end of the year, largely because there is some concern amongst our trading partners, the UK's trading partners, that even though the government has been very clear about the UK leaving the transition period at the end of the year, what they don't want to see is a sort of preferred position for the EU, EU exports into the UK on an ongoing basis that doesn't have, you know, a clear defined end time. So that would be, if you make all of this conditional on the UK leaving the transition period at that time, that would also be helpful to not only to the US, but to the UK's other trading partners. And frankly, it would also be helpful to the UK government's own stated position of wanting to get out of the transition period at the end of the year and to negotiate the trade agreement with the EU. So it's a win-win for everybody other than the EU. So that's why I think it's very much in the interest of both parties to do it. And I think Dan also said something that's very important to bear in mind, which is it is in the interest of the US, and this isn't just the Trump administration, this is all US industry, to have the G5 economy moving away from the regulatory direction of travel of the European Union, whether it's on data protection, GDPR, whether it's on SPS measures in agriculture, whether it's on standard setting. These are all extremely difficult issues between the US and the EU. It's the reason why the US and the EU were unable to agree an agreement between them in the TTIP negotiations. It would certainly change the dynamics of the global trading system to have the fifth biggest economy in the world sort of change its domestic regulatory settings in that way. And I think that would be very much in the US interests, and this is how we would achieve it. And I think the most important thing, though, is to say the point is, the central point is, that the US going down this track of retaliatory tariffs against UK business will not achieve the goal that they are seeking to achieve. In fact, it will move them away from the goal. It's really an own goal by the US authorities here, because it will actually, you know, there will be delight in Brussels at the damage being caused to the US-UK relationship. There will be delight in Brussels to the destabilization of Scotland in the UK's internal market. And they will be sitting quite happily waiting for their own case to come through. And as Dan, you also pointed out, that's a bigger amount potentially. And they will, you know, fire off their retaliatory tariffs against all the usual suspects in the US, whether it's oranges from Florida or Harley Davidsons or Levi Jeans.
And well, let's bring Dan back in on this. Dan, you know, you and Shanker, you're both global free traders. You know, you would agree on that. You're both Atlanticists. So given, you know, what you said about the reality of early harvest measures, what do you think can be done to resolve this dispute? Or should we relax and just say, look, no, it's all part of negotiations. You know, you look at trade negotiations over the years, you always see both sides talking about the possibility of talks breaking down. I mean, in the case of Doha round, they clearly did break down. But isn't this all part of trade negotiations? What do you think, Dan?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, you hear it up until the very end that, you know, we don't have a deal. We're so far apart. We can't bring something like this to Congress. And then, you know, then a deal will come together. So a lot of it is negotiating. It's taking a stance. Things are especially complicated, though, right now, because President Trump has basically he's co-opted Democratic trade policy. So Robert Lighthizer is well liked by Democrats in Congress because he has achieved really one substantive trade agreement, which is the USMCA, and that agreement is not designed to liberalize trade. It really is not. There's nothing liberalizing about it relative to the NAFTA. It is designed to repatriate supply chains back to the United States, to reduce imports from Mexico. Lighthizer and Trump are economic nationalists, and they believe that the trade game is sort of won at the negotiating table, and you use as much leverage as you can to make your opponent kind of hang in the wind and see what how much they will concede. The Biden administration doesn't strike me as a Biden administration, I should say, doesn't strike me as progress on the trade front. The administration is not about to cede crucial voters in swing states to Trump by criticizing his protectionism. And so I don't see the Biden administration extending a branch to the UK government or to prioritizing these negotiations in any way. If you draw the linkage between Biden and Obama and Obama's comment about, you know, if there's Brexit, then a UK-US agreement would go to the back of the queue, I think, you know, Biden would probably say the same thing. And at this moment, the sparse outlines of his trade policy suggest that he's not interested in pursuing any more trade liberalization until we resolve some of the issues, some of the plight facing working Americans. And so I'm very skeptical that a liberal trade agenda is going to be implemented anytime soon. And I don't know whether or not a Biden administration would be, I think a Biden administration would have used different language, would be more diplomatic perhaps, but the goals might, their goals might be incongruous with the goals that the UK government has in achieving an agreement with the United States here.
Okay, so look, Shanker, before we go to the wider picture, I want to stick with a very quick question. if I may, on Airbus. I understand that, I think it's the Airbus have said that they are no longer going to receive subsidies. Is it from the French and the Spanish government? And they'll no longer receive that in the hope that this ends the dispute. What do you think of that claim by Airbus? Is that realistic? And how do you think the US will respond to that?
Yeah, I mean, they've certainly claimed that they're now in compliance with the WTO. But the way that the system works is you can't sort of self-certify that you are in compliance. You know, the panel has to rule on that. And the US's view is that they are still not in compliance. So it isn't simply a question, and this is the issue for the UK that will be a little bit problematic, which is it isn't simply a question of maintaining that you have recouped the launch aid that has been provided to the company. There are sort of historic legacy issues associated with the subsidy in the first place. You know, you've benefited your company, it's got more sales around the world for years, it's built up an entrenched market position over years, and that has to be compensated for. In the eyes of Boeing, that would have to be compensated for. I don't think that's going to solve the dispute. I think there would have to be more from the EU, more in the form of commitments not to subsidize in the future, more commitments on the aircraft sector understanding and the way that export financing is used. And I think in the UK's case, even though they've recouped the launch aid as well from the UK entities, they will probably have to make some commitments on UK export financing. And, this is where the rubber hits the road with the UK government. So far, they have been able to say in their general domestic regulatory policy that we simply want autonomy from the European Union. We simply want control of our laws, as the saying goes. And there hasn't really been a question about what we're going to do with that control that we have. And of course, you know, you could be worse than the EU. You could subsidize more, and that's a sort of open, little bit of an open area. And I think again, this is why it's so important for the UK's trading partners, to the extent they're able to lock in the kinds of reforms that at the moment the UK government seems to want to have. And let's remember, you know, we could easily have had a Jeremy Corbyn-led UK government that would not be particularly interested in trade liberalisation or competitive markets, and would be much more interested in subsidisation. And so, that's one of the, when NAFTA was originally negotiated, it was a very powerful reform document for Mexico. That's why Mexico wanted it. Carlos Salinas went to George Bush and said, he was doing domestic reform, he wanted to lock in the domestic reform with an agreement. And that's the significant power of the NAFTA agreement, was reforming Mexico and ensuring that Mexico became an OECD member as a result. So, that I think the UK's trading partners might want to lock in a more pro-competitive mindset in the UK while they can, knowing
well,
that
Shankar,
it is forever.
On that, I'm going to stick with you. You talked about the UK and what it does with its freedom from the EU. Let me ask you another question on that, which, at a time when one Brussels bubble newspaper had a headline proclaiming, here comes EU protectionism, doesn't this really offer the UK the opportunity to become a champion for global free trade? We heard what Dan said about both Trump and Biden not necessarily being free traders, but can the UK be a beacon for free trade? Is it realistic given what's going on in the US, what's going on in the rest of the world? And also our own domestic lobbies, such as protectionists in the UK farming, fisheries and ceramics industries.
Yeah, I mean, you make a very good point. The UK has to make that choice. If you read Boris Johnson's Greenwich speech, you could not have a more a paean to free trade from a UK prime minister. I don't think there's any head of state anywhere in the world who has invoked in one sentence Adam Smith, David Ricardo, and Richard Cobden. And so the talk is very good. I mean, the rhetoric is very good. The question is, are the actions going to match that rhetoric? And I think, you also play the hand you're dealt. President Trump is the president of the United States. Joe Biden is the Democratic nominee. I agree with Dan's comments that they're going to vie with each other about who can be more protectionist, frankly, in order to win the election. I do differ on one point, which is, I think, you know, President Obama made his back of the queue comment very specifically, A, because he was asked to by the UK government so that the UK could stay in the EU. The prevailing wisdom in the US and in, particularly in the State Department for years, for decades, has been that the UK's role was to make the European Union better. That was its role. And it is only, frankly, when the UK decided itself that it could no longer play that role, that it could not roll back the sort of pressure from Brussels and from the Franco-German sort of European core towards more and more regulatory, more and more anti-competitive regulation and so forth, that it made the decision that it's made. And I think the US, you know, the sort of US foreign policy view of the UK's role in the world and in the EU needs to change, needs to reflect the reality of that change. But having said all that, I think it's clearly right that the Democrats in Congress and Joe Biden, if he were to become president, would not be enthusiastic endorsers of free trade by any means. But I do think there's one area where there may be some possibility, which is they will be looking for agreements with countries where there isn't, as they would say, Dan and I would probably disagree with this statement, but you know, there wouldn't be a race to the bottom on regulations or on labor or on environmental issues. And from a Trump perspective, you know, oddly, both the UK and the US have a trade surplus with each other because of the way we measure these things, which is convenient for both of us. So I think the Biden administration might actually look to see, you know, to look in the trade cupboard at what is there if he becomes president and what is feasible, what could be delivered. Because we also have to remember we're coming out of a COVID pandemic, that there is going to be great pressure on private sector economic growth. Governments are going to have massive levels of unsustainable debt. And there's going to have to be wealth creation. We are going to have to focus again on wealth creation and private sector economic growth. And the only way we're going to be able to do that is to generate economic growth through liberalization, through regulatory competition, and all the good things that I think Dan and I probably agree about. And that's going to affect the Biden administration as much as anybody else. And I think if they look in the cupboard and they see some momentum and they see a UK that is sort of on the same level as the US in terms of the issues that they care about, they may be able to move forward. And I think the other issue, the sort of elephant in the room here, is China. And I think where I would add or clarify, you know, some of the things that Dan was, I think, rightly saying about the Trump administration's approach, they also have recognized, and this is not new to the US, this is something that when I was a trade advisor to the Romney campaign in 2008, we discussed at huge length, which is the role of China and market distortions in China, state-owned enterprises in China, the government restraints in China that have effects all over the world. And we can't, free traders have said in the past, we've sort of said, trade is good, your clothes are cheaper, your food is cheaper, there are winners and losers, tough. That's essentially the argument we made. And unfortunately, in the body politic in the US and in the UK, it's very difficult to politically sustain that argument. You have to have an additional thing. Not to gainsay any of the previous statement. Your food is cheaper, your clothes are cheaper, free trade is good, it's lifted more people out of poverty than any other device known to man. But we also have to say to people, to publics, that where a country distorts its market in anti-competitive ways that ultimately destroy wealth out of the global economy and damage the global economy, we will have disciplines to deal with those market distortions. And there, I think the UK could play a role by finessing the current US sort of what I would describe as a sort of sledgehammer tariff approach. And saying, no, you shouldn't be adopting this, you know, giant sledgehammer to deal with the problem of China distortions. You should actually use a more polished and refined mechanism that conveys a signal to the Chinese that we are open for business with respect to companies, Chinese companies that are not affected by distortions and government subsidies and restraints and so on. But where you do have a Chinese company that is benefited in that way, we will have real and concrete disciplines to deal with it. And that's, I think, the role that the UK can play, is sort of bringing the US sort of back from the brink, perhaps, on some of these issues into a more economically robust approach.
Well, given what you said, Ashanka, I think it's an opportune moment to mention a couple of papers from the EIA. The first one is a paper that will be out by the time this podcast is out, called Chinese Puzzle, where a couple of EIA authors look at the issue of how to deal with China from more a classical liberal perspective, and to stop comparing it to the last Cold War with the Soviet Union and a more sophisticated way of dealing with it. And the second one was a recent EIA paper called Freight Expectations, which looked at some of the forecasts for global trade post-pandemic. And I wonder on that whether I could turn to Dan. Dan, in that paper, in the EIA paper, it not only talks about how the global trading system has been impacted by the pandemic, but it also points out that trading goods actually fell in 2019, and people forget that. And there were pre-existing trends, such as concerns over China, the ones that Shankar laid out, environmental concerns, the local food movements, 3D printing, companies looking to reshore, that might impact global trade in the next few years. So Dan, let me take the picture wider. How do you see the outlook for global free trade in the next few years?
Well, that's a great question. When people ask me about free trade and what the prognosis is, I say, you know what, we don't have free trade. We're still working on it. It's an aspiration. You know, we've had trade liberalization under the multilateral system for, 60 years. We've had bilateral and regional agreements to liberalize trade. So there is an instinct to want to liberalize trade. And economists recognize that free trade is the ideal. Trade, while it's an economic endeavor, trade policy is a political animal. And as a result, we really don't have free trade. But to get back to your point, trade has liberalized considerably over the past many decades, and maybe we are seeing countervailing trends for a variety of reasons. And you know, I think one of the reasons we saw globalization unfold was because we had these revolutions in communication and transportation. We saw the collapse of the Soviet Union. We saw China open up to the West. And so there were opportunities, the regulations, administrative barriers to trade, regulations on capital flows were reduced. And as a result, entities around the world, businesses, investors had options to figure out how to produce things, how best to produce things. And we had globalization. And those investment decisions, those trade decisions reflected, a confluence of factors, including, political risk, economic risks, the workforce skills, access to infrastructure, access to ports, the rule of law. And, you took these risks and you discounted them and you decided whether it made sense to have these sprawling supply chains or to produce closer to home. Now, because of the pandemic, and as you said, before the pandemic, because of climate change, because of local food movements, because of a desire to ameliorate risk by reducing supply chain times, businesses are trading less. There is less intermediate goods trade than there used to be. And to me, that's fine. I don't think there necessarily needs to be an increase in trade. What there needs to be is an increase in the capacity to trade, the freedom to trade. So let's continue to get rid of barriers. Let's continue to give the businesses, consumers, the options to produce where they want, to consume products from where they want. And if it just so happens that dealing more frequently locally than globally is the result, I think that is okay. But to me, the overriding issue, as Shankar touched upon toward the end, is China. The U.S.-China relationship has gone into the abyss. There is a mistaken tendency, certainly in Washington, to blame the Trump administration for this. Now, I was not on board with the Trump administration's approach, its unilateralist approach and its violation of the rules of the WTO to do that. But there are problems there that need to be addressed. And this momentum toward confronting China predates Trump. In fact, to me, Congress, it's the US Congress, it's Democrats and Republicans have been the momentum behind this push. And so if Trump loses and is no longer the president on January 20th, I don't see US policy toward China changing very much. And if we are to take surgical measures, as Shanker suggests is a better idea than this blunt force approach, that means reviewing investments in technology companies. It means enforcing export controls and things like that. And that is going to limit the scope for trade overall with China. So, you know, a recent article in The Economist said, look, the answer is to cordon off the areas where there are security concerns, and maybe we limit trade there or abolish trade there and investment, and then focus on the other areas. Well, if you recognize that trade is beneficial to both parties, it raises all ships, then if we have this adversarial relationship with China in the technology sphere, I don't see how we can logically continue to trade in products that don't seem to have cybersecurity or security ramifications. So my views are, because I expressed this view among the trade community, I think I am perceived as more hawkish than other trade types. But it's not that I'm hawkish, I'm just recognizing that we are going to have to figure our way out of this and realize that when we say, oh, Trump is taking a sledgehammer where he needs a scalpel, we need to recognize that using that scalpel may also lead us to this recognition that we're going to need to scale back our economic relationship considerably. And that will have profoundly adverse effects on the global economy if we bifurcate, if we break out into camps, if there is this Cold War mentality. And by that, I just mean, you know, not an arms race, but, you know, I mean, technology to some extent is the pursuit of technological supremacy is to some extent an arms race, but we need to, we need to figure out how to demonstrate to our populations that we are secure, that we're not overstating the case, that we're not camouflaging protectionism with national security measures, but at the same time recognizing there are legitimate national security measures. The United States might have a different a bigger dog in this fight, to the extent that the United States is the incumbent hegemon being challenged. Americans aren't used to this, and Americans are scared. And so when people say to the United States, well, what's wrong with being number two? A lot of people don't seem to want to accept that. And politicians reflect that, politicians from the Republican Party and the Democratic Party. So I just think that this is going to be something that we're going to have to figure out how to deal with, and it's going to take many decades, I think. And let's hope that we can keep at bay all of our worst instincts in this process.
I should point out that the IA paper, Chinese Puzzle, points out that that the Chinese don't actually necessarily need hegemony. They actually want access for their state-owned enterprises and their companies with links to the Chinese Communist Party, to raw materials, to technology, to know-how, but also to markets. Now, gentlemen, this has been a fascinating discussion. I'm going to ask you both to sum up, and I'm going to ask you a very specific question, starting with you, Dan, and then Shanker. And I'm going to ask you about the equivalent to the elevator pitch, or the lift. If you manage to squeeze yourself into an elevator or a lift in the UK parlance with UK and US trade negotiators, and maybe with Liz Truss, the UK Secretary of State for International Trade, and the United States Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer, I know it'd be a very crammed elevator, what would your elevator pitch be to them about, first of all, about this specific dispute we've been talking about around Airbus, also about US-UK trade negotiations and global trade in general. Dan, I'm gonna hand that one to you first.
On Boeing Airbus, I would say bygones. This is a dispute between the United States and the EU, of which the UK is no longer a part. Figure out a way to end the retaliatory tariffs there, move forward. On the bilateral free trade agreement, I would say, let's unilaterally get rid of our tariffs in both directions. That to me is a great gesture. I think it'd be very beneficial to the United Kingdom. It would help attract investment in areas where there may have been divestment or where some multinationals are considering divesting because of Brexit. That will help to retain it. It will be good for the United States. We should also get rid of the United States should be implored to remove the 232 tariffs that are imposed on the UK. And I would say to Robert Lighthizer, think of the children, because you know Lighthizer's perspective is that there's this fixed pie, and the United States needs to hold on to as much of it as possible. He needs to recognize that we trade so that we can specialize, and we specialize so that we can produce more. We produce more so that we can consume and save more. That is the key to growing the economy. That is the key to wealth creation. So let's keep our eyes on that and not think of these negotiations as a zero-sum deal.
Great. Well, Shankar, now Dan's managed to get to the 108th floor with that very full elevator and made his pitch. And what about you? Suddenly the meetings are ended and they're going back down to the lobby level. What's your elevator pitch?
Yes, from the 108th floor. So what I would say is, look. What do we agree on? We surely agree that we want to live in a world where trade is liberalised, and that you have, you're moving towards free trade and free and genuinely free and competitive markets. That's what we agree on. The question is, how do we achieve that? And the UK and the US are an integral part of a global solution here to achieving that. And the most important thing is that we get a comprehensive, highly liberalizing trade agreement between the UK and the US that is a gold standard. And if I can mention the work that Dan and I did together and with a number of other people on a model UK-US FTA that would achieve those standards, I would have that in my back pocket and I would give that to both of them. And I would say, if you can do that, if you can achieve that gold standard agreement, and if you can therefore, just as New Zealand and Singapore, when they initially started the work that became the Trans-Pacific Partnership, can agree a sort of coalition of the willing group of nations who believe in this, who believe in liberalized trade and competitive markets and property rights protection and all of these good things that absolutely lead to wealth creation and growing the economy and increasing the size of the pie. Let's agree to make that our ultimate goal, and let's get all the obstacles in the way of that goal out of the way, because we have a longer term aspiration here. And if we don't deal with distortions, you know, China is very often used as the poster child for distortions. There are many countries around the world that distort their markets in anti-competitive ways and destroy wealth out of their own economies and out of the global economy. And there is significant amount of wealth to be created if we actually adopted these policies ourselves and used trade policy to achieve those goals. Trade policy is not an end in itself. The end is free trade and free and competitive markets. And maximizing import competition. Ultimately, the end is maximizing voluntary exchange and getting the government and getting distortions and restraints out of the way of that voluntary exchange. So, you know, people can meet together in the marketplace to buy goods and services.
Just in time for the lobby. Great. A great summary there. Can I thank both you gentlemen for a fascinating discussion today. Dan Eikenson from the Cato Institute, Shankar Singham from Compotech, for joining me, Syed Kamal, today. For more details of all our online content, please visit our website, ia.org.uk, subscribe to our YouTube channel, IA London, or listen to our podcast on Podbean. And to help us keep providing free content during these tough times, please do consider making a contribution, no matter how modest, by donating online at ia.org.uk. Thank you for watching or listening today. We hope that you'll join us again soon. In the meantime, stay safe. Thank you.